I'm Al Filreis, and this is Poem Talk at the Writer's House, where I have the pleasure of convening three friends in the world of contemporary poetry and poetics to collaborate on a close but not too close reading of a poem. We'll talk, maybe even disagree a bit, and perhaps open up the verse to a few new possibilities, and we hope gain for a poem that interests us some new readers and listeners. And I say listeners because Poem Talk poems are available in recordings made by the poets themselves as part of our Penn Sound archive, writing.upenn.edu/pennsound. Today, I'm joined here in Philadelphia, as usual, at the Kelly Writer's House in our third floor Garrett studio by Jessica Lowenthal, poet, teacher, associate publisher of Jacket 2, maker of the most fabulous poetry and poetics events, super talented arts administrator, which is to say, director of this very Kelly Writer's House, former Brown University denizen, which might be relevant to our discussion, and author of As If in Turning, and by Julia Block, veteran of Bay Area independent and progressive publishing at Tacoon, Curve, and other venues, a widely published poet, author of Post-Psychiatric Sonnets, and a series of letters to Kelly Clarkson. These are being published soon, yes?
They are, by Sidebrow Books.
Oh, that's fantastic. And I've read them in manuscript, and they're great. Or some of them, anyway. And who, along with Michael Hennessy, is the new editor of Jacket 2. And by Johanna Drucker, book artist, poet, and scholar, whose work focuses on the history of the book and print culture, critical studies, and visual knowledge representation, who's passionate, to say the least, about collection development in book arts, among whose many, many books of all kinds are The Visible Word, Experimental Typography and Modern Art, and Sweet Dreams, Contemporary Art and Complicity. Hi, everybody.
Hi.
Julia, hi. Jessica, good to see you.
Hello.
Again. Every day I see you, which is nice. And Johanna,
so
thank
nice
you
to be here.
For coming to the Writer's House all the way
thank
from
you.
LA.
Thank you.
So we're here, the four of us, to talk about one of the sections, one of the prose poems, I guess you'd call them, in Rosemary Waldrop's book, Shorter American Memory, which was published by Paradigm Press in 1988. In this book, Waldrop derives her texts from sources, classic and some not-so-classic historical American documents, that had been collected by Henry Beston in his book American Memory of 1937, or maybe 1938. The text we'll discuss, or which will at least anchor our discussion of what Waldrop is doing in this book and perhaps in her work overall, is called Shorter American Memory, and our poem Shorter American Memory of the Declaration of Independence. Our Penn Sound recording comes from a reading Waldrop gave in Buffalo in November of 1992, during which she read three of the pieces in this book. So here now is Rosemary Waldrop reading Shorter American Memory of the Declaration of Independence.
I thought I would start out with sort of like a curtain raiser with a couple of pieces from Shorter American Memory. They were my taking liberties with American sacred cows and other sources. I read the collection of sort of snippets from American history that Henry Beston collected under the title American Memory. And then I just went to, and played with all of them, mostly making collages and manipulating in all sorts of ways. I want to start out with... and I called it shorter because, you know, his is a big book, and I reduced it to just 22 pages, you know. So this is... I will start out with the Shorter American Memory of the Declaration of Independence. We hollow these Christs to be self-exiled, that all manatees are credited equidistant, that they are endured by their creditor with cervical unanswerable rims, that among these are lightning, lice, and the pushcart of harakiri. That to seduce these rims, graces are insulated among manatees, discounting their juvenile pragmatism from the consistency of the graced. That whenever any formula of grace becomes detained of these endives, it is the rim of the peppery to aluminize or to abominate it, and to insulate Newtonian grace, leeching its fountain pen on such printed matter and orienting its pragmatism in such formula as to them shall seize most lilac to effuse their sage and harakiri. That's the famous noun plus seven, S plus seven method, where you look up all the nouns in the dictionary and then go seven nouns down and put that one in. And it's especially nice with well-known texts because they sort of shine through.
So she says she calls this shorter American memory, and the reason she gives in her little introduction, which thing is a little disarming, she says the reason it's called shorter is that it's only 22 pages, and she rendered Miss Henry Beston, who had produced a big book, in a small amount of... Is there anything, any other reason why it might be called shorter, Johanna?
Well, I guess Rosemary's memory of America would be shorter at that point. So,
born in Germany and spent a good deal of time in France.
In France. And then I think, you know, part of what I think she's marking here is her own relationship to these, you know, sort of canonical American texts. So her own memory of them is really within a very different, you know, a kind of telescope time frame of her own, you know, sort of frames of personal reference and so forth. So that would be my thought. What are your guys' thoughts, Heather?
She's also taken sort of the most soundbitey part of the Declaration, I think, and really...
It's the second paragraph.
Yeah, really.
We hold these truths.
And the cadence has really come through in the reading, even though the text has been deformed. And so in that way, it seems to... I mean, I read it also as the form doing this kind of commentary on short memory, on short historical memory, on a lack of historical memory. There could be a political critique here, even if it's accidental.
So an accidental political critique, or not accidental in the sense that she created the device and knew she would come out with something
that
could
be called a critique. It's aleatory, even if it's not accidental. Yeah.
Okay. Jessica, your thought?
I would agree that there's something critical, and probably not accidentally critical, that it's shorter American memory, shorter than another sort of memory, someone else's memory, the German memory.
What's N plus 7? What's the she describes the method, but we could describe it a little further. Anybody? Jessica?
Yeah, you select each noun and look it up in the dictionary and count literally 7 nouns later and substitute. Though I think she's...
You think she's playing a little with it?
I think she's fudging it.
Did you find the dictionary she used?
No, but manate is before men in the dictionary.
Men, yeah.
Uh-oh.
So, no, it can't be. It has more letters than man.
Men.
Men plural.
M-E-N.
Oh, that all men rather than...
Wow.
I see what you're saying.
What are you
men,
saying,
men.
Jessica?
I think she's...
She's playing
she's
with,
maybe
the,
she
went
she's
backwards.
Monkeying with it.
And I mean, I think some of them do seem clearly after, but once I saw that one, I thought, well, it seems... Some of the words seem particularly gendered or sexualized or something. Maybe there are lots of choices.
Well, she says, it's only after the reading of this that she refers to N plus 7. She could be somewhat misremembering. She also could be referring to a certain structure that she varied. And before she reads it, she says, I was taking liberties. I love that. Liberties.
Liberties.
I was taking liberties with American sacred cows. Can we read something into that?
Well, of course, we have sea cows in the poem itself. You've turned, you know, the idea of being endowed by one's creator to being endured by a creditor and these manatees who are being credited with something. And so it's this weird kind of, you know, economic language that she's put in there.
Can we talk about sound? Because I think that if you focus on, there's a way in which you can see this immediately as a critique of American sacred cows, of American polity. You could also see it as incredibly celebratory.
Mm-hmm.
To what extent would we say that? Or if we did, what would we say?
Well, I agree, Al. I mean, one of the things that would be interesting to know is what dictionary? Was it, you know, an American collegiate dictionary? Was it a standard American dictionary that's has a particular editorial moment or date of publication? So after all, the era of the Declaration of Independence is one of the great eras of the beginnings of dictionaries as well. So thinking about the dictionary as a kind of device for manipulating this text, with which it is in some ways contemporary.
So in other words, it's appropriate that a dictionary would be used to vary the Declaration.
Their Enlightenment projects, both of them, right? And they have to do with rationalizing language and putting it into some kind of order and then invoking the notions of reason and so forth.
So this is actually participating in the rational project,
mm-hmm,
as opposed to undermining it.
In some ways it is.
I feel like singing the Star Spangled Banner or
So
that would be anachronistic, though.
Yes, it would.
But what about sound?
Well,
it does reproduce this marvelous Jeffersonian,
mm-hmm,
what do we call these? They're more than periodic sentences.
Yeah.
You know, these that clauses.
They're Ciceronian sentences.
Thank you. You know? Exactly right.
Exactly. And because we know where them, these right? people learn to write. They learn to write by reading the classics. And the classics are filled with these elaborate sentences with their qualifying clauses. And I think of them as great thunderclouds of sentences that begin and build and build and build.
We hollow these Trists to be self-exiled, that all manatees are credited equidistant, that they are endured by their creditor with cervical unanswerable rims, that among these are lightning, lice, and the pushcart of harakiri, that to seduce these rims, graces are insulated among manatees, discounting their juvenile pragmatism from the consistency of the graced.
If one wants to be allegiant, this is either good news or bad news. It's good news in the sense that the semantic sense isn't necessary so much as the sound, and that we all have this in us, and it comes shining through, as Rosemary said. The bad news is that it doesn't matter that creator becomes creditor.
Right.
And that might be a problem for someone who's feeling allegiant.
Right, right. At the same time, I can't help but think that there is something kind of American about these substitutions, you know, in addition to whatever dictionary it might be that Rosemary's using, and it'd be great to know that. But there's a tremendous playfulness here because of these choices. They're kind of ridiculous and silly. But the word grace appears four times here. It gets it where it was previously.
It's a substitution for what?
For government. And the idea of grace being so foundational to early American history.
Not to mention Newtonian grace.
Not to mention Newtonian grace, exactly. New government becomes Newtonian grace.
Mm-hmm.
To me, there's a real allegiance to this history, even in these shortened, you know, kind of perverted forms.
Wow, we're coming down on the side of allegiance. I mean, Henry Beston is a very unusual figure. I'm looking at the title page. American memory being a mirror of the stirring and picturesque past of Americans and the American nation, reflecting the forest and the Indian,
yeah,
the colonist and the hearth. He's kind of gone wild.
Mm-hmm.
And when I first listened to Waldrop's rewriting of this, I thought, well, there's got to be a satire of this ridiculous man,
mm-hmm,
and of his chestnuts.
Mm-hmm.
Does anybody want to pick up on that?
Well, you know, the thing that struck me actually,
or the
looking,
pedagogy of that.
Well, the thing struck me looking at the Beston table of contents is how much earlier it is, how much the mm-hmm. kind of first world encounter, the captive narratives, the, you know, the sense of the wilderness and the forest, and the way that the Cotton Mather and the language of you know, the kind of colonial expansion moment, or the first encounter moment, is present. But this is a different moment, and it's interesting that this is the piece she took, because we wouldn't I mean, we love the language, for instance, in True Grit, the way that the language has that kind of authenticity of structure to it and of syntax and of vocabulary. But we wouldn't recognize those narratives. They wouldn't have the familiarity to us in terms of the kind of just repetition in our own lives. And so I think, you know, that she picked, you know, this is significant, you know, because, again, it's the canonical work. I mean, you know, it's like you pick the Lord's Prayer if you're going to make a parody. You know, you don't pick some, you know, sort of, you know, something that's said at the Feast of the 13th Epiphany, you know, on St. George's, you know, Child's Day for the, you know, the little town of, you know, Neo-Bethlehem in the far reaches of the, you know, paratextual, you know, Palestine, because it wouldn't have resonance for us. Or maybe
because
it would
not,
for you, Al.
I don't know. But, you know, I think...
And it's not lodged in that public memory in that way.
It isn't lodged, right.
Two minutes after I thought this is a satire of Beston, who really is kind of an unusual character in collecting these things, I thought the other way around, because I'm familiar with Rosemary Waldrop's A Key into the Language of America, which derives from Roger Williams, and takes something that could actually be a bad, you know, a imperialistic and violent rendering of the Narragansett people, actually turns it around and finds all kinds mm-hmm. of things worth recovering from that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So it may be that she's doing the same with Beston. Julia, you seem to have something to say in addition.
Yeah, I mean, I'm really Bestin has this kind of, I think, endearing passage about the American character drawing from formal literature and the private letter. And to me, that's the whole problem of the American character that Bestin was interested in, that de Tocqueville was interested in, was always this balance between the private individual and the polity or the public sphere or the community. And I think there's something about this procedure that kind of captures that problem, mm-hmm. because to do N+7 is a very idiosyncratic practice. I mean, you're constantly making little adjustments, and having your own attachment to the words you wind up with at the same time that you're working with this deeply public text.
So what is Waldrop's take on the American character? Is she adding to it? Is she qualifying it? Is she undoing it? Or would she be opposed to the very notion that there is such a thing as an American character, Jessica?
I don't know how she'd answer that question, but certainly she's declaring some kind of independence here. She's taking that liberty. So she's participating. And so
you're just rolling out with the puns.
Yes.
Her declaration of aesthetic independence first?
Perhaps, but also the you can take such a public text and do to it is a declaration. Mm. It's a powerful one. It's one that we could all do. So it's also generative and generous. And I think that's part of a certain kind of American spirit.
You know, I guess what I would sort of say and you know, kind of building on what you're saying, but maybe take it in a slightly different direction, is just there's the sensitivity to the cultural history of language and to the historical significances of what you're calling about, these documents that have this incredible public impact. Mm-hmm. So I think part of what we see here is, again, her encounter with American poetics and American linguistic formations is part of what she's engaged with. And I think it's also the outsider's test of understanding. In other words, I think I know what this means, but I know it in translation. So if I do this kind of a translation, then what do I know about what I know? And what does that say back to those of you who know this document and what you think is the original? Because the original, after all, comes to us across a great space of time and encodes its own cultural history. So there are concepts like liberty or the pursuit of happiness or a term like common sense, which is a very, you know, complex concept in 18th century thought, and it doesn't have a self-evident meaning, but it comes to have one through these discursive, you know, formations and discussions and engagement and critique. So I really see this as also, you know, a way to understand language through translation.
So it's a kind of translation.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a translation based on the sound of the words in a way.
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to a translation into, you know, she often talks about her. She's been in the United States many, many years, but she thinks of herself as having an immigrant's point of view. It's one of the reasons why she identified with Roger Williams, who, after all, in the 17th century, was an immigrant himself. So translating the Declaration of Independence by essentially going to the upper limit of poetry where music lies.
Right.
You know, she's sort of a musical or a homophonic mm-hmm. translation
right.
of the American.
But it's not a strict pun translation. It's not like, I don't know, I won't remember the reference, but you know, there's that literal translation of Mother Goose that's done sound by sound and then rendered, or, you
it's
know, some of the
work. Not that.
Yeah,
or
the work
the
of Raymond Roussel, where he'll literally take the sound values and find another set of sound values that's a different semantic meaning.
This is less
right.
pure,
much
wrong
less
word than
pure.
That. But this is also, as we noticed before by talking about the dictionary, this is also engaging in American culture itself by simply going deep, seven deep, mm-hmm. into the American language
mm-hmm.
and finding a way of reproducing the Declaration of Independence by finding other American words. Mm-hmm. Speaking of the
but
American
But they're not
counter,
all American yeah. words, because, I mean, harikari.
Right.
So it raises another question about at what date was this dictionary published, and when does the term harikari come into the English language and or the American language.
And it's spelled in a somewhat antique...
Harakiri.
Yeah, harakiri.
Harakiri.
H-A-R-A-K-I-R-I. And those are our rights.
Yeah.
We have a right to lightning, lice...
And the push carts
of harikiri.
Exactly.
That's just funny. We're laughing.
And
but
we don't
because
just...
they might not be rights at this point. Lice might actually be.
None of it sounds very...
Julia said it was very American earlier, and all I was thinking is lice. It's bed bugs these days.
Lice are inalienable if you've ever experienced them. Julia, what were you going to say?
Oh, that it's not rights in this text, it's rims. And to me, that was also just so wonderful to think about a right as a rim, something that encloses you, something that draws a boundary from one place to another place, or one state of being to another state of being.
That whenever any formula of grace becomes detained of these endives, it is the rim of the peppery to aluminize or to abominate it, and to insulate Newtonian grace, leeching its fountain pen on such printed matter and orienting its pragmatism in such formula as to them shall seize most lilac to effuse their sage and harakiri.
Jessica, you were a student at Brown and you worked with both Waldrops. Do you have something to say about how this might connect to the larger project?
Well, I guess you raise Rosemary's Teacher. I think this is a teaching poem. This is the kind of work we would do in the classroom all the time. This and other projects in
her
book,
own class.
In her own class. I mean, N+7, but other procedural approaches to poetry to get us away from whatever it is that you think is poetry when you're a freshman. So for me, this is what poetry is. All of her work, but this in particular, this book, I think.
Very nice. Julia, your thought on Waldrop in general that we can get from this?
Yeah, it makes me think of her work, Love Like Pronouns, and ways in which she sort of concretizes concepts and ways of being, ways of feeling in language, and then kind of detaches them again and defamiliarizes them for us. And this poem, I just really enjoyed it because it was so suffused with memory and history and feeling at the same time that it was, you know, reminding us how material language is, as Johanna was saying.
Might we even be so radical as to say that it's good to have a shorter memory?
Some of us are getting to the point where we have no
where
choice.
We have no choice. What were we talking about? What poem is this?
I think the risk is always to sort of set memory in stone and think that we can't be critical or questioning of it in some way. I think the poem is extremely thoughtful about what memory is, whether it's memorialization or an untouched history or a sense of something being, you know, totally static.
I guess I would almost, this is almost a bibliographical note, but those who are coming to her for the first time will want to know she spent many, many years translating Edmund Jabez, and he, of course, is obsessed with and writes beautifully about the problems of memory, post-Holocaust memory, and representation, and nationhood, or belonging to a nation. And these are all relevant, I think, to this. Johanna, your thoughts on this question of where this gets us to a larger appreciation of Waldrop's work?
Well, I guess I appreciate very much her seriousness and her sense of precision about language. But I think the other thing that I see two things here that are really central for me. And one has to do with, again, her life as a translator, that this is somebody for whom language is almost always about translation because of her own displacement. But what that also does, I think, is make her relationship to subjectivity and selfhood within the production of poetic language really one step removed from any sense that the lyric voice or the authorial voice is somehow already there or already given, that it's always a construction in relationship to received language and cultural position. So for me, that's really quintessential in the way these moves take away, as you were saying, Julia, any sort of Jessica, any possibility of simply seeing poetry as this, you know, sort of lineage of, you know, expressive voices or lyrical voice. Instead, it's a self-conscious construction in relationship to received text, received moves, received ways of producing, composing, and thinking about the basic materials of language, syntactic as well as semantic.
The long-time project of the Burning Deck Press makes her one of those people like you, Johanna, who thinks all the time about the book. And it seems to me that when I read this chapbook, Shorter American Memory, all I could think of was the relationship she had with this Henry Beston book and the way in which she was doing a book of a book and so forth. I mean, I think that seems quite crucial to her. I kept thinking that I was reading the rewriting of a book.
Yeah. I think that's true. Even I love the little headpieces, which we can't see online, but the decorative elements at the top of the work, they're the line engravings. And again, it gives a kind of period flavor to the way in which the work appears on the page. So those kinds of cues, those kinds of graphic notes also introduce a kind of historical resonance in the piece. It's, yes, this is a contemporary move to make, but it's a contemporary move on a historical text.
Yeah, right? It's a 90s rewriting of the 30s rewriting of the 17th and 18th century. The design, you guys know more about design than I do, but the design is not colonial so much as 30s.
Mm-hmm.
It's a Henry Beston kind of, this was the great moment in the Depression of the kind of consolidation of certain, you know, movements within historians.
Mm-hmm. Well, the 30s is a period, after all, when, you know, the humanist reinvention of the humanist typography has gone back to the Renaissance and to, you know, the period of Incunabula for its inspiration, and then it's absorbing moderne, sort of streamlining, linear, you know, organic forms. And you see that in these pieces. So it's both of those things. So it's deeply humanistic, but it's very much modern. Mm-hmm. So it's a modern humanism in terms of the design.
So before we gather some paradise, let's go around and I want to invite each of you to say one thing that you haven't had a chance to say about this poem or what it suggests to you. Jessica, a last thought?
This isn't something I didn't get a chance to say, but I want to dwell in a word that Johanna used, which was encounter. It seems that is such a good word for describing what's happening here. And encounter is such an important American word, and it's a critical word. It's not without weight.
Key to the American language, yeah. Key to this moment in her work. So that's a great suggestion. Julia Block.
I'm also dwelling on a word which is cervical, which used to be certain in the original. Certain unalienable rights has become cervical unanswerable rims. And that word cervical, it has to do with the cervix, but also generally with the neck and generally with the space where speech comes out and words come out. And so to me, that was such a wonderful accident/choice/ whatever it was in Rosemary's Dictionary.
She knew more about the Jeffersonian sentence than he did by thinking about it as the sort of rhetorical mode is so much more important than the semantic meaning sometime in Jefferson. Johanna, the last thought?
Yeah, part of what drew me to this work is its irreverence, which I'm always happy to see in any work of art, and its humor, which, you know, I believe that humor is the road to enlightenment, and also to think about the fact that there's a wonderful history to proceduralism and to conceptual work, and this is in the 80s, but there's a prehistory to this, and it just points back to a wonderful anthology from the 19th century called Jeu philologique, in which the kinds of procedural moves that are currently part of an anti-expressive conceptualism get a lot of play, and I think to do the archaeology on these activities is also to reinform ourselves with other moves that can be made and the pleasures of these kinds of acts of deformance. Mm-hmm.
Fabulous. Well, we like to end Poem Talk with a minute or two of what we call Gathering Paradise, which is a chance for several of us to spread wide our narrow hands to gather a little something really good going on in the world of poetry and poetics or book arts, as the case may be. So I would invite each of you to gather some paradise. And why don't we go to Julia for the first little bit of paradise.
I want to gather some paradise elsewhere on the Penn Sound site, if that's okay, which is the newly posted, for us anyway, recordings by Lorraine Nitaker, including her wonderful poem about Thomas Jefferson. Been having a wonderful time with those recordings.
It was complete luck that we refound the Nitaker recordings in Penn Sound. They were there, but we didn't even know it.
Wow.
It's extraordinary, and I do recommend that people listen to that. Jessica Lowenthal, Gather Some Paradise.
I'd like to point to Erica Baum's Dog Ear, which that isn't what I was going to talk about today, but I'm thinking of its very textual material nature. It's little folded pages that bring together
dog ears. Dog ears. The corner.
Corners of pages. So
that
interesting.
That reproduces different texts.
Encounters with
and
words.
And published in Jacket 2, or at least part of it published
Just parts.
That's great. Johanna Drucker, Gather Some Paradise. Can
sure.
I just say it's paradisal to have you here at the Writers.
Thank you. You know, Anna Arner's wonderful study of Stephen Mallarmé's Ankou Dede and other work has just come out from the University of Chicago Press under the title The Book is Instrument. It's a magnificent publication, quite large in format and filled with color images, and it's an exemplary piece of scholarship about Mallarmé, but also about how we can look at poetics in relationship to larger cultural activities in the crisis in publishing in the 1880s and 90s, and problems of fashion, and also of pedagogy and so forth. So I highly recommend it. It's a fantastic work.
Thank you. And I guess I'll just recommend Mike McGee, who wrote a little poem called Pledge at one point, which rewrites the Pledge of Allegiance in a slightly different way. But look it up. I think it's online, and it's lots of fun. Well, that's all the lightning, lice, and harikari we have time for on Poem Talk today. Poem Talk at the Writer's House is a collaboration of the Center for Programs in Contemporary Writing and the Kelly Writer's House at the University of Pennsylvania and the Poetry Foundation, poetryfoundation.org. Thanks to my guests, Julia Block, Jessica Lowenthal, and Johanna Drucker, and to Poem Talk's director and engineer, James Lamar, and to our editor, as always, Steve McLaughlin. Next time on Poem Talk, Jerome McGann, John Timpane, and Tom Devaney join me here to talk about Edgar Allan Poe's very weird poem, Dreamland. This is Al Filreis, and I hope you'll join us for that or another Poem Talk.